KVU Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the We Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month is Nacho Drum, showing Thursday, January 21st at 7 p.m. Released in 1993, Nacho Drum is a French documentary about the Romani people's journey from Northwest India to Spain, consisting primarily of music. Again, that's Nacho Drum, Thursday, January 21st, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Mike Crenshaw.
And Monica Beamer.
We're your KBOO station co-managers. We wanted to say thank you to all of our members for helping KBOO to exceed our goals in December. We appreciate everyone's generosity and commitment to KBOO, and we can't do all that we do without you.
We wanted to thank you for helping us to meet our $10,000 one-to-one match for new and increasing donations in November and December. We met our goal. And thank you to all the generous foundations and donors who created the match that encouraged new membership.
We have a lot more to do in 2016, and we can't do it without our members, our volunteers, and our whole community.
Thanks for keeping KBOO strong.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, Keith Lee Morris, is the author of the novels The Greyhound God and The Dart League King, and the story collections The Best Seats in the House and Other Stories and Call It What You Want. His stories have been published in Tin House, A Public Space, The New England Review, and The Southern Review, which awarded him its Eudora Welty Prize in Fiction. Morris is a professor of creative writing at Clemson University and is here today to talk about his new novel, Traveler's Rest, a book described as Alice in Wonderland meets The Shining, as a perfect mixture of horror and fairy tale, as belonging in the company of Shirley Jackson's The Haunting of Hill House and David Lynch's Twin Peaks, and by Publishers Weekly in its starred review as quiet and languorous, sweeping steadily and inexorably along like a curtain of drifting snow, identified too late as an avalanche. Welcome to Between the Covers, Keith Lee Morris.
Thank you.
You've expressed surprise that people in the United States are calling Traveler's Rest horror, given the absence of gore and violence in your book, and also given the fact that you've been writing what you call dream stories for much of your career, and that really the only big departure is that you're now writing a novel-length dream story. So before we talk about Traveler's Rest, why don't we start with your long engagement with dream narratives in general, and tell us what you find compelling about dreams in relation to story.
To me, I got interested in writing stories. I mean, in a way, it was kind of an exercise in trying to force myself to not to think out my plots too much. I have a tendency to want to sort of understand the architecture of stories before I start them, which can actually be a little bit inhibiting. And so working from the dreams was a way to make myself sort of write intuitively. Like I would start with a piece of a dream and I wouldn't have anything else really in mind. And I would just start going with it and I wouldn't really know where it was going. And I learned how to do that in writing short stories. A novel's a whole different thing, right? I mean, you start trying to write a novel and you have no idea where you're going and you suddenly, you know, get partway into it and that's more difficult. And that was kind of the challenge with this novel. But I wanted to, dreams are interesting to me because I feel like we tend to think that's not part of our regular life. That's not part of what we're really doing. But we spend how many hours a day or how many hours a night actually dreaming, and that the dreams have an effect on us and they stay in our memory and they're real things that happen to us in some sense. And so I wanted to write a novel in which the whole thing felt more or less like a dream, or the characters can't tell really whether they're awake or whether they're dreaming in some sense, that the whole thing exists in a kind of dream state.
It kind of reminds me of Ursula K. Le Guin's comment about stories that don't have dragons. Like human beings imagine dragons and need dragons. And if you have stories without human imagination or the imaginative faculty, they actually aren't realistic in a strange way.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and the fact that a lot of narratives, I mean, you know, they don't take account of the idea of dreaming and that sort of thing. I mean, it's interesting though that, like you talk about, there's no genre for dream stories, which has been kind of the difficulty with this novel in a way is how do you categorize it? And well, to me, it's just like a literary novel that uses elements of, say, haunted house stories, but that exists in this kind of dream state. There's really not a genre for that. I don't really even know people who've talked about it that much. There's a professor at the University of Illinois named Philip Graham, who's actually written about dream stories or dream narratives. Other than that, I don't know anybody who's really dealt with it much, you know?
Well, with the craft of writing a dream story, how do you deal with the issue of stakes and consequence and suspense when maybe anything could happen versus
the set parameters
of the world?
Right. So you have to kind of, to me at least, so there's a randomness to dreaming. There's, or what I like to think of as dream logic. Right?
Right.
It has its own separate logic from what we experience every day. But you're right. There has to be something going on there that you feel has some kind of consequences in the real world. And that's sort of the trick. But I think that's what I kind of set out to find when I start trying to write a story like that is, okay, so where is this going and why does it matter in some way to the people who are in the story? And that's the same thing with this novel. And it took me quite a while. I mean, it really did. It was, you know, it was really scary to be, say, 80 to 100 pages into a book and not quite understand what was going on or where the thing was going. That was really the most difficult part of the book. I think the first, say, 80 to 100 pages of the book took me maybe 3 years. And then the last 250 pages were about 6 months.
Wow.
Once I kind of figured it out.
And you mentioned at the beginning that you starting a novel, it's scarier not knowing where you're going. But you've also talked about an acronym that you use to sort of keep you on task around things in this dream world. So can you tell us what MADFIST is?
So I was reading Proust, Remembrance of Things Past, the whole time, which is basically one of the only books that you can read that takes longer to read than the novel that you're writing at the time.
Right.
And so for years, I'm, you know, wading through Proust, and a lot of the, I think a lot of the thematic concerns in that novel started kind of leaking into my novel. So yeah, I had this thing. I would tell myself, especially when I was out running. I run distance running, and I would tell myself, you know, it's MADFIST, whatever's going on. So memory apprehension, as in understanding, not fear. Memory apprehension, dreams, family, identity, solitude, and time. It's like, okay, those are the things that the book is about, and so I would think through elements of the plot. It's like if something's going on that doesn't have anything to do with one of those, you know, then I'm off on the wrong track. So I would go out running and I would tell myself MADFIST. And I'd try to figure out parts of the plot and say, okay, what's going on that has something to do with that? But it's a really complicated book. It's by far the hardest thing that I've ever written. And so, yeah, I needed some sort of almost like mnemonic device to keep me on track.
So Traveler's Rest begins with a family driving back across country from Seattle and getting waylaid because of a once-in-a-century snowstorm. They end up pulling off the highway in a small ex-mining town in the panhandle of Idaho called Goodnight. And that's where your novel takes place, stuck in Goodnight, Idaho, in this dream logic town, essentially. What was the original impetus for this? I know with your stories, it was often actual dreams,
right?
But I've actually read that with this, it wasn't an actual dream, even though you're working in a dream world.
Well, it was. It just it was going to be a novel called The Beach House. And my family, we vacationed down in St. Simon's Island, Georgia. It's a little town off the coast in Georgia. And it started because I had this dream about the beach house we stay in. I walked around the outside of the house and saw a window that I knew was not actually there, that I knew didn't belong in the house. And two people were in the window talking to one another. And that was actually the dream that started it. And so I started trying to imagine who these people were, what they were doing there, what it had to do with the family, and started to construct the novel So there were scenes like on the beach and, you know, surf and all this kind of stuff. And then I was in Wallace, Idaho at a friend of mine owns a microbrewery there. And I happened to be there because I was doing a book tour. I happened to be there on the night when the brewery opened. And so me and some other friends went there and we were sampling the merchandise. And after a while of that, we had another friend whose mother had bought an old hotel in Wallace, this old abandoned hotel. And he took us in there during the middle of the night with a flashlight, no electricity or anything. And we're wandering through this hotel and it was crazy. It was this crazy place with these stairways all over everywhere. And one of my friends actually managed, he went into a room and closed the door and it had no knob. The door had no knob on it. And he managed to lock himself in this room. And that's really where it kind of came from. I was like, okay, this is way better than the beach. I'm using this old hotel, you know, in this old mining town. And so
there's a spooky history to Wallace too, with the mining accident.
And that happened when I was a kid living in that area where they had, I think it's still actually the U.S.'s biggest mining disaster, where it's like 91 people were killed or something. And we lived in that area. So, I can, you know, and school was called off, you know, everything was closed down. And, but I can remember, you know, you'd go around town and I knew, you know, people whose parents were in the mine and only two people made it out alive. So it was a really weird, strange period. And then later on, you kind of associate that place with that event so that it does. Yeah, it seems kind of scary.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to Keith Lee Morris about his latest novel, Traveler's Rest. There's a review of your story collection, Call It What You Want, that reminds me also of aspects of Traveler's Rest. So I'm going to just read you a little thing of this review and see what you think. Characters are constantly engaged in the act of narrative construction. Again and again, Morris structures his stories to obscure actual events, thereby forcing the characters to remember, speculate, or fantasize them into being, much like writers do. Only these characters are not writers. They are a meth addict, a car salesman, a bartender stranded on a desert island. And this idea of like speculating and remembering and fantasizing the events into being feels like something also about Traveler's Rest, because these characters are sort of separated from their family and trapped in almost their own minds and their own memories. And the town itself is sort of separated from the world and trapped in a memory in a strange way. What's compelling about that is a construction, which obviously goes back before uh-huh. Traveler's Rest.
So part of what I was trying to work with was the idea of, I mean, I have two kids myself. Both of them are grown now. I shouldn't say kids because one of them is 23, the other one is 18. But having raised two sons, you know, you go through that whole thing when they're younger and you're trying to construct this family and, you know, you want it to be sort of impenetrable and just kind of, you know, nothing bad can happen. You're trying to create this world where everything is safe and secure and everybody is connected to one another, but we're really all alone. You know, I mean, when it gets right down to it, it's each of us by ourselves and there's nobody else there. And so I wanted to, and I think that's what I do typically is sort of put characters in that position where they have to feel their own isolation and they in some ways have to confront their own identity separate from somebody else's identity, separate from all those kind of social constructs that we spend most of our time in. And right, so that's I definitely was interested in that with this novel, that I was really conscious of the idea of getting the main characters in this place and then separating them all so that they're all together in some sense, but entirely alone at the same time.
Well, this seems like a good segue to Proust and returning to what your relationship between Traveler's Rest and what you were reading at the time of Traveler's Rest. Because you begin the book with an epigram from Proust, and then each section of the book has an epigram from Proust. Your prose syntactically and tonally doesn't read to me like Proust necessarily. It doesn't have all those nested clauses and super long sentences. But what's interesting to me is it feels like there is a relationship between Proust sentences and the geography, like you've almost given a geography to Proust sentences, it seems to me, in the way that his sentences are mimicking like the way memory works in a recursive mind and traveling through memories. And it sort of unmoors you from the present moment and from physical space and time. Your story is structured with scenarios nested within scenarios and time periods that intersect other time periods, sort of like if Swan's mind had been given a spatial dimension. I don't know if that feels right to you. But I'm curious more. I want to lean harder into this Proust connection because you definitely repeatedly bring us back to Proust as we go from section to section in the book,
which was not, you know, that wasn't the original intention. I started with the first epigraph from the first section started off to be the one that was going to be the epigraph for the whole book. And in fact, the original title for the book was Movable Things, which is a quote out of that original section there. So then all of a sudden that kind of evolved and there were different parts of the novel and it was kind of like, okay, well, there, you know, I want to find something in Proust that can be used to identify what's going on in those sections. But I actually feel like I do feel like in a way some of the sentences are Proustian, I guess, that there are some long involved sentences that kind of meander around and go back on themselves. I felt like that, and I think you're right, which may frustrate some readers, the idea that the book kind of keeps turning back on itself in some way and there's no sort of straight line forward, and there are places where you feel like you're almost reading the same thing that you've read before, which is maybe not a great strategy. But I was trying to do that intentionally. I wanted there to be a point in the book where the reader sort of feels like, yeah, this has been going on forever. We've been here a long time. And I know that that's dangerous as a fiction writer, that you're risking the idea that the reader's going to put the book down. But I felt like, you know, if I can establish that as a theme, and I can establish that as the way that the novel is working in some way, and the reader understands that, then they'll stick with me as they go along.
Well, I love how you insert some physical objects that are also sort of doubling down on this nested reality. You have a snow globe, a haunted or ailing television, the mirrors, and then the gumball machine, which all literally mirror in miniature the larger world. So it's almost like holograms of what's going on in the book. And so you have these different lenses from which you can look at Goodnight Idaho or any individual character in the book's consciousness, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it was at one point I even toyed with the idea of calling the novel The Snow Globe or, you know, So right, I was definitely aware of that, the worlds within worlds, and the idea of characters who there's a lot, like you point out, a lot of stuff with mirrors and reflections, and people who are looking out at one thing but seeing themselves at the same time in some way.
Well, let's have you read from Traveler's Rest. We picked a part of that I think does have some Proustian elements to it, and definitely deals with this idea of dreams within dreams.
This is from the middle. This is the main, the mother. This is one of the main characters, Julia. She dreamed that she had a dream about something she should remember. In the dream that she was dreaming she was opening the door to a room and something important was happening on the other side of the door. She could feel herself leaning into the truth concealed by the door, but she couldn't fit the key into the lock fast enough before the dream she dreamed she was having ended because she dreamed of waking up, outside in the snow, standing in front of a window reading the letter about the key. This dream made her impatient, because after all, she'd already read the letter in a different dream, or what she had thought was a dream before she seemed, at times, to be in possession of an actual key, which actually did open the door to room 306. But in this dream, anyway, she was impatient to get back inside the hotel. She hurried through the falling snow as best she could, taking small steps in an unwieldy pair of shoes, ankle boots, really, which she didn't recognize as her own but liked immensely just the same, holding up her long skirt in the snow, a skirt she didn't recognize either. And then she suddenly found herself standing outside the door to her own room, and she pressed her ear close to the wood, listening for noises. It was in her very own room that the important thing was happening, the thing that had been in the other dream. She was spying on someone, she realized, but she didn't know if it was herself or someone else. What did she think was going on behind there? She heard a man's voice, and then the low, muffled voice of a woman, and recognized in a hot wave of embarrassment that she was listening to two people having intercourse, but she didn't know if it was herself she was listening to. She was mostly curious to know who the man was, so she began very quietly to fit the key to the lock, and it was the fear of finding out something about herself, something she didn't want to know, that woke her from the dream of turning the key in her own door to watch the couple, whoever they were. And when she jerked awake in bed, sitting straight upright, naked, she quickly looked down to find out if she was with anyone, if she could still catch herself in the dream. No one was there. There was the impression of a head on the other pillow. The sheets were tangled on that side of the bed. When she put her hand to the mattress, on the other side from where she slept, it was warm to the touch. But she was confused about who might have been there. She was alone in the room and everything was white. All she could see was snow everywhere she looked, as if she were flying through a whole world of snow where nothing was solid, where she was weightless and suspended. She knew she hadn't eaten in a long time, and she felt so light in both her body and her mind that it was as if she didn't exist at all. She had been dreaming, hadn't she? Of what? She couldn't remember. But she was awake now, or she thought she was awake, if that word meant anything anymore. She rose and stood naked in front of the mirror. Julia. Julia was the woman in the mirror. And as had been the case lately, when she stood in front of the mirror, there were other Julias, each just a little fainter, each just a little further removed, reflected behind the first Julia. But there was no mirror behind her to create the reflections. And as always, when she stepped away, the women in the mirror followed her, one by one, each just a fraction of a second behind the one before her. Slipping on her nightgown, she found that the key was in her hand, and she moved to the door and used the key and passed into the hallway. She was hungry, that was all she knew, and not necessarily for food, though food would do. She floated down corridors and through rooms and up and down stairways and narrow passages, cold and light, like a faraway star. She did not find what she was looking for. She never did. She had been in this corridor for years.
You've been listening to Traveler's Rest by Keith Lee Morris. So, Keith, there's this discussion in the book, which this section hints at a little bit, about the nature of self, whether the self is something biologic or whether it is socially constructed. How would you articulate these two different theories?
That's tough. I feel like what each of us is trying to do all the time is to sort of exert our own will, that we're all trying to exert our own self-control to have some kind of way of shaping what happens in our lives. And yet it's really difficult. And sometimes we feel like there are outside forces that have more to do with where we end up than our own will and our own decision making. I feel like that kind of tension is there in the novel. And each of the characters, again, being sort of separated from one another, each of them on their own separate journey, trying to get back to the others, trying to do something that can determine their own fate. To me, it was a little microcosm of what our lives are all about all the time for all of us.
Well, it really comes to a point with the father, Tonio, because he realizes in his isolation that his self is solely defined by his relationship to others, being a father to Dewey, being a husband to Julia. And in a way, it feels like you separating all of the characters is a contemplation on whether the nature of self could be inherently relational, interdependent,
right,
versus something like individual and biologic.
And with with the father, Tonio, he's the least likely person in some way because he seems really iconoclastic and really kind of introverted, and he's a little bit of a curmudgeon in some way. And yet he's the one that realizes in some sense that he almost doesn't exist outside of his relationship, especially with his son, and that this has kind of happened over the course of all these years without his realizing it in some way. It's only at this point when he's separated from his son and his wife that he begins to understand that that's who he is the person who has this relationship with these people.
Well, you tell Traveler's Rest through four rotating points of view, the wife, the husband, the kid, and the uncle. Did you learn anything in particular? Was one really difficult to do versus the others, or one just so natural and easy for you
to
do?
Well, I guess I would say, Robbie, the uncle, who's, a drug addict, and he's just out of rehab, and he's a screw-up, basically, was pretty easy for me to write. I've written that character before. I've known those people, right? I mean, that's familiar to me. And he could have easily, out of the characters in this novel, I think Robbie is the only one who could comfortably sort of walk into one of my other novels, kind of show up in the middle of one of my other novels and be at home there. So he was fairly easy. And then Dewey, I think, as the 10-year-old kid, I got into his head. I probably, again, he was kind of a combination of both of my sons. I kind of took characteristics from both of them and put them into Dewey. So those were the easier ones. The husband and wife, Tonio and Julia, were tougher. Those were the two. Yeah, those were the two harder ones.
Well, it is interesting that your story collection is half, your last story collection is half realistic stories and half dream narratives. And here, The Dart League King and Traveler's Rest almost feel like they could be a realistic and then a dream story with Robbie being the link between the two.
Right.
Well, let's talk about Idaho as setting and muse. You have this great essay in A Public Space about your hometown in Idaho, which posits a three-part theory about writers in regards to hometowns. I don't know if you remember the three
Good
parts,
God, yeah.
But I can read them to you if you don't.
You tell me. Yeah.
Okay. So, so your three-part theory about writers and their hometowns. We're never sure we know any place as well as we know our hometown.
Okay.
We aren't sure that the people we are now are really as much us as the people we were then.
Okay.
And this feels interesting because this toggling between two versions of your characters in Traveler's Rest in two different time periods sort of raises the ante on number two.
Uh-huh.
And then it's not so much that we can't go home again, it's that we don't go home again. And I love that last one. So what I imagine, what I wonder about the last one is you've lived in South Carolina for a while.
20 years.
But you still write about Sandpoint or areas sort of near Sandpoint in Idaho. What is the difference between now sort of Keith Lee Morris's imagined Idaho and going to Idaho? It must not match up all the time now.
Right. Well, I guess the ways that my hometown of Sandpoint, I guess the ways that it's changed are the same ways that small towns all across America have changed in some sense. So it doesn't feel that strange to me to go there. And I do feel that it's kind of strange to be separated from the place that you feel like you're working with in your fiction most of the time. And there's a certain amount of anxiety in feeling that you're not getting it right. But I still have all the same friends there. It's still geographically, there's this beautiful lake, there's this same, it doesn't feel that much different to me from how it did when I was a kid, really. And so I go there once a year or so, usually for several days. It's a way to stay close to the people and to the place. And I guess I don't feel like there's that much separation. It's not, when I go there, it affirms the things that I thought I was going to find in some way. You know, it's still the same place.
And you share a hometown with another great writer.
Boy.
Marilynne Robinson,
right?
Which I love, and I love her book Housekeeping, which is set in Sandpoint, although she doesn't call it Sandpoint in the novel. And it's fun. I mean, most people there don't even know who she is or know anything about her, really. There's another, Dennis Johnson, who's also one of my favorite writers, lives up just, 25, 30 miles north of there in Bonner's Ferry. And most people don't know he's there either, huh.
Well, it's remarkable, actually, Idaho with Anthony Doerr,
right.
And Brady Udall, I think, is in Idaho.
Alan Heathcock at Boise State. Mitch Wieland, and where I'm from at University of Idaho, Kim Barnes, Daniel Orozco, Mary Clearman Blue. It's all these great writers there. It's strange that you got, and most of us, I think, we know each other.
Yeah. Well, let's return to the question of whether Traveler's Rest is a horror novel. And at the beginning, a lot of the American reviews are saying that are making a nod towards the horror genre. But you've mentioned that while this book has come out at the same time in England. And in England, it's not being called a horror novel. In England, it's actually set in a historical perspective with like a ghost story, like Dickens'
right.
ghost story.
Well, I just kind of think what I've seen, I don't know. I mean, I can't keep track of exactly, what's going on in the UK with it, but it just seems to me that when you, or maybe it's the idea of just a different definition of what a horror novel is in some ways. And in the UK, it seems to me that when reviewers start talking about the novel, they associate it with things like A Christmas Carol or The Picture of Dorian Gray. And so they're not thinking of it, as The Shining or Texas Chainsaw Massacre or
right.
something like that, right? So it's just, I think it's just kind of a little... As far as I can see, and if you look at the cover of the UK version, it looks even more like the cover to a horror novel. To me, it seems like it's being marketed even more that way. But I just think there's kind of a different understanding of what that means.
Well, what other books other than Proust would you think are books that it fits into the same family tree with for you?
Other than I don't know that it necessarily fits with Proust. I don't know. I wish I could say. Turn of the Screw by Henry James. I mean, I could definitely see some kind of similarity there. There's a short story by a writer named Conrad Aiken called Silent Snow, Secret Snow. That one was really in my mind as I was working on this. It's about a boy who is sort of becoming delusional, and you feel like he's kind of slipping into almost a state of catatonic schizophrenia. That sounds really depressing, but it's a great short story, and that definitely was in my mind. Mark Danielewski's House of Leaves, which I loved the first, say, 100 pages or so of that book. I thought it had these. Have you ever? I don't know if you've read that.
I haven't read it. I know what it is, though.
There's this crazy kind of metafictional stuff that goes on there. It becomes kind of a novel about novels. And that part of it I wasn't as crazy about. And I can remember reading that book and thinking, if you just stuck to the plot here and just dealt with the characters and didn't go into then this would be a fantastic book. And so, in some way, I was trying to take the meat of that story and create something of my own that didn't sort of go, to me at least, kind of so far afield. Those are the things that Shirley Jackson, Haunting of Hill House, definitely had that kind of feel to it. Another novel by British writer Doris Lessing, The Fifth Child.
I love that book.
And that book and the way that it deals with family and how things can go wrong right. in a horrible way had something to do with it.
Well, you wrote an essay in The Independent about Christmas ghost stories where you sort of muse about why winter is a good time for the supernatural. But there was one little nugget in there. I think you mentioned that short story you mentioned by Conrad Aiken
right,
in there.
Right.
But you also mentioned this great vignette of Mary and Percy Shelley and Lord Byron.
Right.
Where they are like doing a dare to all write ghost stories. And quite significant literature came out of that original dare. Can you tell us a little bit about that scenario?
Well, so that I mean, you know, the story, who knows how apocryphal it is, but I mean, apparently they all did. They were all in Lake Geneva, Switzerland. This is Lord Byron, Percy Shelley, Mary Shelley, and other friends there. And it actually was, it's interesting, it was around this, you know, so it was early 19th century, was the coldest summer ever, apparently, at the time. And so there's nothing to do outside. They all got together and told ghost stories. And none of them really panned out. All of them had these ideas, except for Mary Shelley's, which became Frankenstein. So there's this idea of somehow in the middle of the winter, and the novel starts on January 2nd, and I was really conscious of the fact that this idea of also starting a new year, but you're in this really cold period, and there's this massive snowstorm of historic proportions, and I knew, you know, and then when Little Brown decided they were coming out with the book, almost on the same date that the novel starts at, that felt right to me. It's like, okay, it is kind of a winter novel for sure.
And people probably don't, a lot of people don't realize how much there's in Frankenstein, the poles. I think they go to Antarctica.
Yeah, they end up, right. It's been a long time since I've read it, but so it literally ends up with Frankenstein, or, you know, Frankenstein's monster, or whatever you want to call him, sort of floating off on an iceberg.
Yeah.
Right, up in the North Pole somewhere.
Very snowy and cold.
Yes.
Yes. You've said before that some writers think of story as art as the same thing as a painting, whereas you see a book as a form of communication, as a conversation. Can you elaborate a little on that?
I mean, I think of myself as a storyteller more than anything else, and I don't. It's not that I don't. I mean, I don't blame writers who think of themselves as artists. I don't care. It doesn't. You know, I'm not saying that I think that they're pretentious in some way. It just, that doesn't occur to me. I mean, I don't, and I think when people talk about craft and there's so much attention to technique and what people used to call, sort of refer to as the cult of the sentence, right? Like it's all about writing beautiful sentences. And I hope I'm writing nice sentences, but that's not really what it's about to me. You know, I'm more involved with character. I'm more involved with story. I'm more involved with theme. So that sometimes I have to be, it's interesting because I had a really, really exacting, kind of difficult editor with this novel, Ben George at Little Brown. And I wanted him to be the editor for that reason, because the book was really complicated and I wanted somebody who was going to take me to task for all of the small decisions that I was making on a line by line level, because that's not really where my thinking is all the time. Mm-hmm. And I knew that I needed that for this book, that I needed somebody who was paying that kind of attention to every line. And he did. It was a long, tough process.
Wow. And how much did you feel that you needed to get the history right? Since part of the book is taking place in the distant past, when maybe Goodnight Idaho had a more bright future.
Yeah, you get stuck in that. I mean, it's tough because you feel like you know, you want to get it right, but you don't want to be obligated to do it exactly the way it happened, you know? So you don't want to feel like you're trapped or stuck in some historical version of the town. And so it's kind of a fine line. I mean, I do feel, you know, with at least within the parameters of the story. So I know how the town is operating in terms of the story. And within those parameters, I want it to be right. So you do a certain amount of research and you go back and you look at these things, but then I think it's a matter of saying, okay, I refuse to be obligated to get it right outside what I set up as the parameters, right? It's my world. I invented it. It's my place. And so I'm only accountable in terms of my own imagination and the way that I'm dealing with it.
And do you have any inkling what your next project's going to be?
I've kind of got this, again, it's a North Idaho thing, but I've kind of got an idea, may or may not be the next novel. I've kind of got an idea that I'm going to write a short novel about a bunch of guys in the 80s on like one certain night who are going out. They've just graduated from high school and they're trying to pick up girls in this small town. And they're in a green Ford Pinto with racing stripes with an 8-track. And they only have one 8-track tape, and it's the Cars Candio. And the first song is Let's Go, if you remember that. I think the novel's going to be called Let's Go. They're driving around this whole night listening to this one CD, miserably failing at the idea of picking up girls in this. I think that's where the next novel's going.
And is that a dream that you had?
No.
No, this is not a dream narrative.
No, I wish it were a dream, but it actually was more related to real life. Yeah.
Well, it was great having you on Between the Covers today,
Keith. Thanks. Appreciate it.
We are talking today to Keith Lee Morris about his latest novel, Traveler's Rest. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
The KBOO Foundation is seeking to fill two vacancies on the board of directors. The board will elect the new directors at the February board meeting. Are you interested in nonprofit governance and in helping to shape the future of your community radio station? Do you have 10 to 15 hours per month to support KBOO? Then this may be just the right opportunity for you. The application and instructions are posted on the KBOO website, kboo.fm, and paper copies are available at the station. In order to be eligible to fill one of these two vacant seats on the KBOO Board of Directors, you must be a KBOO member and you must submit a complete application by either emailing the document at kboocommunity@gmail.com or by mailing or dropping off the completed documents to the station to the attention of Timothy Welp, KBOO Community Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Please send in your application by 5 p.m., February 15, 2016. If you have any questions, please contact the nominating committee at kboocommunity@gmail.com. Thank you for your support of community radio.
Ten years ago, a plot was hatched, where evil was with cunning matched. Whoever left their doors unlatched would find their infant children snatched by monster boys. Ooh, no!